So welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. I'm here with Trent Larson from the Magnetic North Acquisition Corporation. It's a bit of a mouthful. And today we're going to talk about, I guess, trying to get underneath the skin of an investor and understand really what drives and motivates investors in investing and the businesses that they're looking for. So Trent, you have quite of an illustrious career. You've worked in some very, very large companies. Can you tell us a bit about your background and how you got into the Magnetic North?
Certainly. Okay. Well, so first of all, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and speaking with your guests. But so I started off with big corporations, as you're familiar, you know, with IBM. And while at IBM, I did some work around a lot of my work was around intellectual property. And to date stamp that, I'm gonna date myself here. Mm-hmm. Think of the time of the notorious Napster downloads, file downloads, and everything.
Right.
Which was perceived to be illegal, which at the time it was illegal. And I was with the digital media team with IBM. So we were running around trying to implement technology and so forth to prevent this file download activity.
So the fingerprinting that was done early on.
Well, it was at that time it was called digital rights management.
Yeah,
DRM. The term was. And that term has kind of died away over the years. But
because that was quite clunky from what I remember, that you had to always download something and then pass
it. Well, it wasn't. What was happening is the content providers, meaning initially it was the music labels, but then onto the studios and movie studios and so forth. Initially, they were trying to maintain control of that asset. So even though it was a digital asset and it moved from their control to perhaps your device, your MP3 player, they wanted to be able to switch it on and off at, you know, if you haven't paid up or whatever it may be, they wanted control of it. And I think what we've seen now is that whole business model has migrated to streaming.
Sure.
And so there we go. We spent, there were millions and millions of dollars spent on that rights management, which is now pretty much by the wayside. Mm. But so during that time, I was, we call it the Digital Media Group. Now, that's when, you know, the assets, the digital assets, music and movies and later on games and so forth, were controlled by these owners. And in fact, my first foray into advisory work is I worked with the European Commission on trying to hammer out what their digital policy was. You may ask yourself, okay, well, digital policy from a European Commission, tell me more. So when you think about the works of Mozart, Beethoven, it's all in the public domain,
right. But
it can't be used for certain purposes or for commercial gain if you try to claim rights for the composition aspect of it. And you also think of the works of, like, for example, the Mona Lisa, digitized image of the Mona Lisa. These are all in the public domain, but what's fair use? How many times can you reproduce it? And how many times can I reproduce it? What can we use it for? You don't want the Mona Lisa or some of these great works of composition of music being used in ways that wouldn't be a fair representation of the composer or the artist. So that was an interesting time, but that was advisory work. That's where I got my feet wet in advisory work. And then from there, I moved on and did more advisory work with some of the big four consulting firms, which took me to California. I worked with not only with music labels, but also some of the film studios. But it was all centered around intellectual property. And so the two things that were emerging from my career, advisory and intellectual property, and many years in between. And then I arrived at meeting up with a group that then formed Magnetic North Acquisition Corporation. The skills that I brought to the table were experience in advisory, was experience in intellectual property, and also I had a fairly global network by this time because I'd lived and worked in a number of different locations. So that was kind of what brought me to the table, and we had a good synergy and we moved forward from there.
So what the Magnetic North, what do you guys do? What's your raison d'etre?
So Magnetic North is an investor, obviously, and we've recently just done a transaction, taking the company from a private company to a publicly listed company.
Right.
And so that offers a few more avenues for funding and so forth. But Magnetic North, as an organization, is very focused on investing in IP-rich organizations.
Right.
And when I say that, typically the organization is going to have a patent of some sort or a technology or trade secret that is unique and it has global application. And we like to say, and we're having a pretty good track record of this, it has a profound global impact when scaled. So we're working with organizations in this area. And you know, I'll give you an example, and this is recent and it's very timely right now, is one of the companies we've invested in is a company that manufactures a hospital-grade disinfectant and hand sanitizer.
Right. Okay.
Now, this particular product, it's been lab-tested by the FDA in the U.S., so the Food and Drug Administration, is also with the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and has proven that it is effective 100% with the Class A viruses, such as COVID-19 or coronavirus.
Sure.
Now, the exciting part about
that... Did you bring some with you, by the way?
Well, I didn't. I should have. But the exciting part about this is that the... And it's a patented product, but the design of the product is to be sustainable, or that it has a sustained kill over a long period of time.
Right.
Now, if you can imagine from a hospital standpoint or from a school or you know, any public place... If you can sanitize it, disinfect it with a solution, and it persists for days, weeks, and in some cases, if the design behind it was if you bond it to a nurse's gown or the greens from the doctors, if you bond it to a fabric or a carpet, it can persist for months at a time. So think of the profound effect that can have when there is an outbreak such as coronavirus. Now, we've worked a long time with the FDA and with the EPA to have this tested. And right now, what they've done is they've approved it for labeling as a 24-hour effective kill. And we're working with them to get, you know, to do more testing so we can prove that it does have a longer sustained kill.
So these kind of companies, I mean, they're not, you can't find them on the street. They're not everywhere. So I guess you must be working mostly with universities or kind of labs, or you know, how do you, because if you're IP rich, then obviously there has to be something behind it. There has to be some sort of, usually some sort of money behind it, and originally to do the research and innovation.
So, Bharav, and now to this particular one that I just spoke of, it's called Previcare. It was one of the founders of the company. It was he was doing some contract work or pro bono work for the company.
Right.
But what we focus on is we don't usually find our investments from or our investment companies from a university. They're a little too early stage for us. We look at what we like to say is a company that has their widget is already developed. It's proven. They'll have a couple of customers and they're either soon to be cash flow positive or just cash flow positive. So they, you know, they kind of got past the initial founders issues. Right. And now they're into scale-up mode. And that's when we come in, because our whole philosophy is that we'll invest capital plus, well, competency or management, if you will. So anything that we invest in, we bring in management as well to sit next to the existing leadership team and help them grow the organization. Chances are they were the ideal people to start the organization, structure the patent, get the patent established. But now from a growth standpoint, they could use a little bit of help, which is what we bring.
So this is an interesting point, because this is a conversation I actually had yesterday with a company that hopefully we'll work with at some point. And the founder was saying to me that, you know, he perfectly understands that in 3 years' time, he may not be that CEO. But I find that a lot of people don't recognize that. They think that they basically, once they start the business, they're going to be there for the next 20 years. They don't really see that the skill sets are different from going from the first years of growth, gaining the first customers, and then being a solid business and actually sustaining that business. So, you know, where do you see where do you see the challenges for founders in this respect? For the companies that you work with, is it a hard conversation to say to that person, well, actually, you know, you've done really well getting this far, but actually you're not going to be the best person going forward?
The best founders are the ones that understand their limitations.
Right.
And what do you think? I mean, you've worked in consulting as well. You've worked in advisory, and that's all about understanding what you bring, what someone else can bring, and how the combination of them, 1 + 1 exceeds 2. And the best founders to work with are the ones that really understand that. And they know that they are not the right person to begin raising funding, or to take this international, or to have it certified by the FDA. That's not their core skill. They were brilliant at establishing the product. They were the scientist that really understands this. But the best founders are also the ones that understand there's still a role for them in the company. It may not be what they've been doing in the past. And in most cases, they're not comfortable having to now take that leadership role whereby they're in front of the media, they're being scrutinized by the banks and by the board. That's really not what they signed up for. They were simply passionate about that initial widget they developed. And that's their baby. They want to see it thrive and survive. So, on the other side, there are some times when the conversations are a little bit more difficult with the founder. If the founder, sees things going in a different direction. But we try and work that through when we perform diligence on the organization. We really try to get to understand the leadership of the team. Is this someone we can work with? Or is this a group we can work with? They may have the most fantastic widget, but if we just don't feel that we can work with the leadership, we'll probably pass.
So this actually brings me on to a point that someone else mentioned to me a while ago, that when they're looking for investments, they typically go for, well, kind of the exact words he said to me were, I'd rather invest in a great team with an average idea than a great idea with an average team. Is that something that resonates with you guys?
That works 100%, because the great team is also, when you invest in the great team, they could take, they could take the most obscure item and turn it into something successful, or at least they would recognize when it's not going to work and they can pivot. And that's probably the key difference, is that they don't ride this sinking ship to the bottom. They'll know when it's time to, tweak it, adjust it, modify it, throw it out, start new. You know, they have that ability. And so that's really why it's important to get the A team with a B product. Hopefully, if you can get an A team with an A product, yeah, that's your nirvana. But A team with a B product is much better than a B team with an A product. Now, the only caveat I'll add to that is that as we invest a lot in patents, if the intention from the very start is we're simply going to acquire the patent and the founder wants to ride off into the sunset, sometimes that's a good outcome as well. Mm. So, if we see an A product or an A patent, we will look at it from that perspective.
So one thing I've always wondered is, how joined up are your investments, in the sense that, of course there are certain traits that you're looking for in companies. There's a social global impact. There's a patent piece. But, if you've got 10 companies in your portfolio, are they all in very similar areas? Are they in very different areas? Are they in the same industries? Or is there kind of a thread running through them all? Or how's that look?
The ones we found that work the best are when there's a common distribution channel, so that if we've got a product A that requires perhaps a medical distribution network into hospitals and healthcare, and product B may not be synergistic from the same type of product, but if it uses that same healthcare medical network, that really helps us a lot, because we've already established those relationships, right, and it's quick, it's time to market then. But other than that, we keep a very strong advisory board, independent advisory board, that has expertise in in medical imaging, or in waste management, or in water reclamation and water treatment, so that we can look at very diverse different opportunities and call expertise onto it quite quickly, and within a very short period of time get a gut feel whether it's worth pursuing further or whether we just step away and invest our time elsewhere.
So you mentioned that previously there's a management team that you tend to bring in to investments that you make. Where do they come from?
Well, in the early days, it was just personal network.
Right.
And it's the old thing, Barrow, that you put a few smart people in the room together and magic starts to happen. And that's what we found. If you get the right people that can bring an opinion, and a skill set, and they're not afraid to give their opinion, qualified, that helped us move forward on a lot of different things. Now that we're maturing a little bit more, we do have access to a wider network. It's not just our own personal network that we started with, but we do have access to advisors and to people that have a number of letters behind their name, and they have qualifications that, from an independent standpoint, they can help guide us.
So I talk to a lot of businesses about their journey and how they started and how they grew. Now, with Magnetic North, were you one of the early employees? Were you one of the first? Or what was the journey itself of that fund? I mean, do people... Again, I'm just going to come from not a devil's advocate, pure position of ignorance, and I'm going to say, do three guys get in a room saying, I've got $1 million each, let's go and do something with it? How do you actually start this one?
Well, and it wasn't quite like that. We had some clever people, and then there was me. And you've heard about imposter syndrome. You think, sure. Okay, why am I here? What am I bringing to the table? But each of us, we had to look down deep and inside and think, okay, what value could I bring? So now I do sit as an independent director, so non-executive director for the organization. But the actual founders, some very clever people, and they came with a background and a history on a good track record in investment banking. So they brought the financial perspective to it. And then they were, they were involved, as I say, one of them was actually involved with this disinfectant company from a very early stage. And they started to realize that the collective group all had involvement in some, like in various different companies that all had potential to them. And so the founding member said, you know what, we should actually pull this together under the structure of a venture capital corporation, and then we can not only have capital, but we can then bring management to help these various different companies. And then it was a case of, and so I was one of the original board directors. Then it was a case of starting to build that out. We just did standard, what's the desired state, current state, what's the gap? And we looked at the gap, and we had some skills gaps, and we just went out based on our network and worked to fill those skills gaps.
Okay, so it sounds like you almost had a soft landing with the investments that you were making, but how easy was it to start? How easy was the first investment, for example? It must have been a bit of a learning curve for you guys, or?
Yeah. Now, again, the people that are actually steering the ship, they had years of experience in investment banking, so they were much more familiar with the process. And
so you say that though, but I having worked with investment bankers who've then gone into working companies, there's a huge gap, right? Mm. The skills gap is massive, because working in an investment bank, everyone is motivated. There's a huge support network around you. You start your own company. You're interviewing people who you're paying maybe £18,000 a year. And I remember one person said to me, I don't understand why they're not working, 24 hours. And I said, because you're paying them £18,000 and they've got a family. That's why. And so, there's a lot of kind of, not just, an emotional quotient or whatever it is. It's not just that, but there's also kind of practical skills that you need to have around building a business that you just don't get as an investment bank. Functions of marketing. Again, another person said to me, I just didn't understand the function of marketing. I just don't understand it. So, how do you get your product out there? So there is something, having that background doesn't necessarily mean that success translates into human investing, right?
No, it doesn't. But a couple of the characters that we were working with at the start of the company, they'd also taken operational roles in other companies,
right.
And so they had seen more on the ground, hands-on activity. So they brought a good, solid pedigree with them from the investment banking space, but they'd also had some hands-on experience with local business.
So then, going back to when we're talking about great teams and great ideas, so does that, within that great team, do you necessarily have to have that? Do you feel that they have to have that operational piece in there that they should have worked in a business, not just theoretically?
Well, here's the thing. The short answer is yes, and then I'm going to caveat that and say there has to be fresh thinking. There has to be a fountain where you're drawing fresh thinking from all the time. And as we all age a little bit, we tend to get more entrenched in our thinking, and we don't look outside the box. So, we do need to draw from different talent. We need to draw from different advisors. We need to bring different perspectives. And a lot of times, those are people who are much younger than myself. Mm. And, they may not bring certain skills from a corporate standpoint, but they understand a lot of the issues and the items and the interests that the next generation is going through. And therefore, we can hopefully position ourselves to help service that.
So just talk a little bit about the kind of investment scene at the moment. Are you finding it easy or hard? Are there lots of deals out there to be done? Because I keep hearing there's lots of money out there, but then when I speak to companies, they seem to find it very difficult to get the money. So
what I characterize that as scared capital. And then really what's happening is we're just now emerging from a fairly prolonged period of time of scared capital. Brexit was a perfect example. Now we finally got certainty in the UK as to where we're going. And so that has just, in the matter of the past couple of months, and you can see that there is movement now starting to take place. This capital has been sitting there for a while, not sure where to go, has started to move. Now, if we go across the pond, we look at the US, there is the impeachment proceedings and so forth. That has, for the most part, died down. So again, we're seeing a little bit more willingness to proceed and move forward. Also, you know, a little further afield, the US-China trade relationships. Those have, again, started to, you know, we haven't got a final outcome, but they're starting to thaw, and it looks like there will be a successful outcome there. So when you combine those things together, we're seeing a fairly large geopolitical shift in terms of people's willingness to make investments. So I think you're right. I think that up until recently, there has been an unwillingness to part with money. At least the scrutiny was much, much higher than it is now. But now people have a little bit more certainty as to what they see the global economy turning out as. So they're saying, yes, we've got to get this capital moving.
So I'm assuming that you guys are global investors. There's no territory that you won't look at as such. So where do you see, what excites you at the moment? What part of the world do you find exciting? Where are you seeing some ideas that are coming through and thinking, wow, these guys in this part of the world seem to have it nailed?
Well, we're resource constrained in terms of a bandwidth to get across all the different opportunities. We have a lot of great opportunities coming our way. The concentration right now has been North America and more recently in the UK. We're seeing some fantastic stuff coming here. But we've been active in South Korea. We're spending more time over in mainland China. And we're seeing opportunities come from all over the place. The investments that are the front runners in our portfolio right now are North American based. But we are working very quickly on some other ones that are sourced from different locations. But coming back to what I mentioned earlier on, they all have a global application and they all have the potential to be a global game changer. So really what we're focusing on, and you know, it didn't start out this way, but luck kind of tends to fall in your lap sometimes. And we've been lucky that many of the projects now that are coming to us and that we are progressing with have a very profound social impact. They have a global benefit. This hand sanitizer, hospital disinfectant is a perfect example.
What's interesting there is that that's a product that is fairly straightforward, simple, and you can already get out there, right? And it's not, because people, when people talk about it needs to be a game changer, it needs to have a social impact, you kind of, in your head, suddenly you think it's got to be a huge, massive thing that overarches multiple different countries. Do you know what I mean? It feels like it has to be a big project, but actually this is something small that can have a major impact.
Yeah, it's small, can have a major impact. As we are a listed company, I do have certain things that I'm not able to discuss openly. And you know, maybe when these become more public knowledge, it could be a follow-on conversation we have. But we are working on some things that will have truly a globally profound impact. And it will change it'll change lifestyles, it'll change people's quality of life significantly.
So how long do you guys tend to work with your companies? So because obviously you sound like you're smart money, because we all talk about dumb money, smart money, people who can come in and actually make a difference to the business rather than just throwing cash at it and expecting a return. So how long do you tend to work with the business? Do you kind of have a cutoff point, okay, we only want to work with X number of years, or is it organic?
So we have stage gates that we like to work towards, and that, you know, so there's no real defined time frame, but if it starts to go beyond 10 years, and we haven't been in business for 10 years, so we haven't got to that point yet. But if it were to start to go beyond that, if it looked like it was going to be a fairly prolonged venture, we'd have to understand the value that's being created. Is it worth it? Or is now the time to, you know, to do, go through an event, liquidize it, whatever it may be, and move on. So, but as part of our diligence, when we are looking at organizations, we're very focused on that particular issue. What's the global impact? How quickly can we scale this? And then what is the likely outcome that will be suitable for everyone? So obviously we take the founders into consideration. We take our investors into consideration on that decision. And we go in with a fairly open mind.
So you're a non-exec for Magnetic. So what is your day job other than, or is this your full-time?
So I do spend a lot of time with Magnetic North. It's
and you invest as well. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I invest with it. And I also do advisory work. So I've been working to help organizations get established in the UK. I do a lot of telecom advisory work as well.
Okay.
And I'm on a couple of other boards.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at in a way is that you've got a past with some large, very large businesses. How has that prepared you for your journey now and working as an investor and actually thinking like an investor? The methodologies that you've learned within places like IBM or KPMG helped you at all, or is it just the network that's really helped?
Well, both, but let's just focus on the big corporates. So IBM, KPMG. A couple things they taught me is that first of all, the more quickly you can establish process within an organization, the faster you can scale, and there are probably fewer organizations better than IBM and KPMG and these large corporations that have stronger processes. So that was really key. The other thing that I found interesting with my career with IBM, KPMG is that I always found myself in a startup organization within the big corporation. I mentioned to you from a digital media standpoint, well, I was employee number two in the digital media team across Europe, Middle East, Africa. So I was at the very front of that organization and we grew it quite quickly. And then later on with KPMG, established their digital practice in Los Angeles and grew that. So there's kind of a theme where my comfort zone is getting in on something that is relatively small but has big potential and trying to grow that. And that fit very well with, you know, with a venture capital firm and what they do.
No, I think you're very right. I think that's one thing that I tried to talk to companies that we advise and try to get them to think about their processes from the day one, but they never, but a lot of them really don't understand the need for them. And you know, I always sit there and say, okay, we can't build IT unless you know what the process is that you support, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense otherwise. Yeah. So from a personal investment perspective, rather than the Magnetic, how does your mindset shift there? What do you look for if you're personally investing in a business as opposed to Magnetic?
Well, I feel more comfortable investing in a business where I understand more about what the organization does. And so my background from technology, digital media, I was in broadcast for a number of years as well. So all around the technology standpoint, I at least bring a point of view. So I'm comfortable there. Now, more recently, I've worked with healthcare organizations, health tech organizations, and that's becoming an area of proficiency for me as well. So, and the common theme there is that one of the highest growth areas for health tech and healthcare is IoT. Mm. IoT, of course, grew out of arguably digital media or out of technology and telecoms. So, there's a common theme that goes across there. And then, of course, underpinning everything is the massive amounts of data and data analytics. So there's a kind of a common theme there where I find myself most at home.
So when you're investing, what do you see as success for you? Is it, because everyone wants a unicorn, but that's highly unlikely, right?
Yeah. Everyone wants to see the unicorns, but I think from an investment standpoint, it's good to see the financial metrics aside, everyone wants to see their money grow faster than if you just put it away in a bank in a savings plan with 2 or 3% interest. So anything above that is probably considered a success. But what is really rewarding is when you see an entrepreneur, a founder, a small organization that transforms itself from just a group of people with a great idea to now a properly functioning organization, a corporation, one that's scaling, one that is meeting the needs of customers, one that is able to employ people, hopefully do some good within the communities they work in. You know, that's real rewarding. And when you see the growth from the founders themselves, one of the things I do a lot is mentoring. I've worked with the MIT School of Mentoring. They have a venture mentoring services, VMS, and I've been accredited as a venture mentor. So I really enjoy working with people, seeing their journey, and oftentimes seeing where they started from and where they end up. So there's quite a reward from there.
So here's an interesting question for you. When you're, not that the other questions haven't been interesting, but so when you talk to someone just leaving university, and given that you and I have had very similar paths when it comes to large companies, what advice do you give them if they say, should I go to work for a KPMG or should I start my own business?
Well, one thing I would advise them is that we will approach a time when virtually everybody is a business of their own and they're simply providing their services to the big corporations. Mm. You know, the big corporations might have IBM may see the day when they've got an employee staff of 200 people and the rest are all the affiliate model where people are just contracted to them. Yeah. So I would prepare people to, you know, that are leaving university to understand what their value is and also be trying to build their value. You know, don't come out of university and think, okay, I'm done. That should almost be the beginning point because your curiosity really kicks in. At least mine did, probably yours as well, when you left university. The curiosity started taking over. Okay, what could I do now? And I found it very exciting working with organizations like NDS and like IBM, like KPMG and beyond that. So I would encourage them to be prepared to identify what their core skills and key values they can bring, but be flexible. I think what's happening, and I've got my wife and I have two, our children are in their early 20s, and they're trying to make a decision as to what it is they want to do for the rest of their lives. And I'm trying to guide them saying, look, don't make a decision today that you have to stick with being our daughter's studying to become a vet. You don't have to be a vet for the rest of your life. There's a certain amount of investment you got to put in up front to be that. But what if you, you know, keep an open mind and what you start with today may not necessarily be what you are in 5 years.
Oh yeah, definitely. And it's like, that's the same for most businesses as well, right? So most businesses are not the same on day one as they are on day 365, right?
Yeah.
What I find interesting is that, as you say, people tend to be a little bit set when they come out of university. I mean, I did a law degree. I ended up in IT. And that was because, and that was after interviewing at all sorts of different companies like, well, back in those days, GlaxoWelcome, BP, Mars. I went through all of it, Sainsbury's, just to find out what was out there and what could you do. And I think that's probably something that people don't necessarily do as much. Maybe I'm unique, but I don't see people kind of come out of university thinking, yeah, I'm going to do this and this is what I'm going to do. And then after that, I'm going to start my business and have that blueprint. Whereas I think really you need to go out in there and see many more new things and actually work in a large corporation. So you know why you don't want to work in a large corporation.
Yeah.
Because there's no, and actually you learn a lot from them. As you say, processes are there and there's a methodology. There's a reason these companies have existed for so long. And it's not necessarily just because they employ great people. It's they have the processes and the networks to support them. So yeah. I think, yeah.
And large corporations will have good training and many good things about them. And one of the things that I still say about large corporations is that they work really well for many people. Obviously, they employ a lot of people, and there's a lot of people that love being in those large corporations. I wasn't one of them. For whatever reason that was, it didn't really fit my career path. But I do appreciate the training and the foundation that they gave me.
Definitely. So if someone wanted to, someone's listening to this and thinking, well, I kind of like the idea of investing in companies that are sustainable, but not necessarily I don't have the money. How do I get involved in an organization like Magnetic? Do you employ juniors? How does it work? If someone wants a career in investment or VC, venture capital, what would you say to them?
So I would advise them to, first of all, take stock of what value they offer. And everybody, even people that are fresh out of university, they may think, well, I haven't got the experience, but they do have skills. If they played on a sports team, chances are they've got skills in order to, perhaps leadership skills, perhaps they've got skills to influence people, to organize others. So take stock of what your skills are. And if they're looking to join a venture capital corporation, find out, do a little bit of homework on that corporation. Just like the VC would do diligence on a company they look to invest in, someone should do diligence on the VC and understand what type of investments do they make? How big are the investments? Where do they operate? Is this something where I see myself doing? You know, if a VC is very, very focused on investing in meat production and cattle farms, but you're a vegan, chances are you're not going to bring the passion. So you just need to understand a little bit more about them. So I would suggest do your diligence on them. Understand what you bring. Quantify that. Build out your network. All of these organizations look for people that bring a number of skills, but a key one is bringing a network. Mm. And then start to passively approach them. Approach me, approach other people in the firm or other venture capital firms. Have a conversation. Learn more about them. You know, people are all too willing to talk about what it is their company does. And so I'm sure they'd be happy to give you 10, 15 minutes. Once you understand that, then you can start to position your value. And you may have to say no to a lot of different organizations because they simply don't fit what your values or what your interests are. But eventually you'll find the ones that do fit.
All right, so the last question that I ask everyone, if you could go back in time 20 years and give advice to your younger self, what advice would you give yourself?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I thought about that for a little while, and you may remember Jack Welch, who was the chairman of GE, who incidentally just passed away on March 2nd. So I'll probably use this as a tribute towards him. But he was once asked a similar question, and he said, "Never drink cheap wine." So I'm not sure to what extent that was meant to be, but presumably he was trying to indicate, you know, enjoy life every day while you can. But that's Jack Welch. Now, myself, I've lived kind of by a philosophy from a very young age of I would rather regret something I have done than something I have not done.
Sure.
And that has carried me fairly well. But the advice that I would probably give myself is that I would probably start investing at an earlier age. And there's a number of reasons for that. And we can remove the financial aspect of it. But if you start investing at an earlier age, and it could be even $10 a month, if that's what your budget is, it drives a lot of behavior in you. It drives consistency. It drives a discipline in you. In most cases, people are not going to miss 10 pounds a month or $10, whatever it could be. Sure. But at least it shows that you've got a value for your future. You're thinking about where you're going, and it puts a bit of rigor and structure in. So that means you've got to be, you know, you've got to be out there every month earning an income. So, as I mentioned to you, we've got two kids in our family, early 20s. I shouldn't be calling them kids, they're young adults, but early 20s. And this is the advice that I'm giving them, is start early and start, just putting a little bit aside, because with compounding interest and so forth, you know, who knows, by the time 20, 25 years goes by, they've got enough for a significant investment. Could be paying off a mortgage on their house. It could be acquiring a company if that's what they wish to do. But I think it's a good practice for people to get into, to have that kind of rigor, and it just builds discipline.
And I think that's one of the biggest issues now for millennials, or I don't know, millennials anymore, Generation Z, whatever it is, that they're not saving enough for the future.
Yeah. And I think that then goes back to the expectation that there always will be money coming in, and that you know, with the way that the world is changing, and people will be corporations of one, individuals that are subcontracting their services out, there will be a time when they will be between roles. We talk about the gig economy, people are going to be between roles. So this just helps them build that that structure, but it also gives them kind of a mindset of abundance, if you will. So they feel like, okay, yeah, I am doing well. Boost confidence in themselves. Yeah. So that's the advice I would give myself. Also, one thing that I do recognize, and it's probably more in hindsight, but I value my network. And I don't want to, you know, consider my network to be, just a group of names on a database. These are people that I care about, that I want to engage with, that I spend time with, that I'll assist them whatever way I can. And valuing your network and from a very early age, I think, is a very good piece of advice.
Excellent. Well, thanks for that, Trent. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Good. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Cheers.